Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this ordinary general meeting of the Institute of Actuaries. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on the 22nd of January 2007 have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Yes, it looks as though I may. Good, thank you very much. We have a number of guests with us this evening, and may I extend a particular welcome to Lawrence Churchill, the Chairman of the Pension Protection Fund, David Norgrove, the Chairman of the Pensions Regulator, and Ian Tower from the Retail Firms Division of the Financial Services Authority. And also I'd like to welcome all personal guests of members. Now, I've been asked to mention some housekeeping issues before we start the real purpose of tonight's meeting. First of all, the meeting is being filmed in order to produce a webcast. There's clearly a lot of interest in the subject. And we're hoping to make that webcast available to members only from Friday of this week. Secondly, the fire alarm is a continuous ringing tone, and should you hear this during the meeting, please make your way calmly and efficiently, it says, to the assembly point, which is outside the Melton Mowbray Public House. Now, most attendees should know where the Melton Mowbray Public House is. But just in case you don't, you go out into High Holborn and turn right, and it's about 50 yards along on your right. Anyone wanting to claim CPD for this meeting should make sure that they sign the forms that are being circulated on clipboards during the course of the meeting. And finally, may I ask that you turn off your BlackBerries and mobile phones, as the signals for both interfere with our sound system. And it says here it's not sufficient to mute the ringing tone because your organiser or phone will still try to talk to its base, and this is picked up by our equipment. So in a minute I will have to deal with my own BlackBerry. Now, the subject for tonight's meeting is a discussion on the topic, should projections of mortality improvements be subject to a minimum value? I suspect we're going to go a little beyond that single question, but it's clearly a good opportunity to discuss projections of mortality improvements in general. Now, the discussion is going to be preceded by a presentation by Stephen Baxter. We're very grateful to Stephen, partly for stepping in to produce a presentation for this meeting at relatively short notice, and secondly, for picking such a popular topic. So I'd now like to invite Stephen to deliver his presentation and open the discussion on that topic. Stephen.
Thank you, President Nick, and good afternoon all. This afternoon I'm going to introduce the question of whether or not mortality improvements should be subject to a minimum value. To be very clear about this, by mortality improvements, I mean how the probability of dying during the year of age X, i.e. the QX value, changes from year to year for fixed age X. The improvement is defined as the decrease in that QX value from 1 year to the next. So the improvement for specific age X at a certain point in time T is given by the formula on screen, where QXT is the QX value at time t. Over the course of this presentation, I hope to convince you that in order for our mortality projections to look credible, this value should be subject to some minimum value. I'll provide a value for each of men and women, which, based on historic trends, could be used at all older ages. Before I start, I should stress I'm consulting pensions actuary. and coming at this very much from the point of view of a practitioner. This means I'll be taking a deliberately simplistic and pragmatic approach to the topic. In particular, my focus is primarily on the post-retirement mortality assumption used for valuing pension scheme liabilities. When setting the assumption or thinking about the assumption, I typically split the problem into two parts. The level of mortality a scheme is currently experiencing and the projection of these mortality rates into the future. I expect I'm fairly typical in currently using the 92 series projections for this purpose, albeit with an allowance for the accelerated improvements seen amongst recent retirees, i.e. via the interim cohort projections. In doing this, I am reliant on the basic 92 series projections to provide for any underlying level of long-term improvements, for instance, achievable via medical advances, lifestyle changes, and improvements in healthcare. In recent months, I found myself wondering and questioning whether the level of improvements assumed in these projections is adequate, or whether perhaps I should be subjecting the improvements to some minimum level. With this background in mind, I will be basing the presentation on the improvements published as part of the 92 series of tables. Despite this, I believe that everything I say is equally valid a consideration when analysing the output of different projection models. The next 30 minutes or so will be a whistle-stop tour of the way I've tackled the question, and in particular, I will need to cover the topics on screen. I'll recap what we're assuming when we use the 92 series projections, before moving on to consider trends in life expectancy, and in particular trends in older age life expectancy, which I define as life expectancy from the age of 65. I'll then briefly look at underlying trends in mortality rates and provide references to some of the more detailed analysis that's been carried out. I hope by this stage to have argued that, based on historic trends, some level of minimum improvement is necessary, and will have provided an indication as to what level of minimum can be justified. However, I will pause to briefly consider more subjective issues, such as whether or not the past may be considered to be a guide to the future. Finally, I will discuss the practical implications of applying a minimum level of improvement. To start with, let's recap on what the basic 92 series projections assume for mortality improvements, and these are illustrated by the chart on screen. With year along the axis from left to right, and age starting at age 60 at the back and coming forward to 120 at the front. So the top left of this chart is showing that there was an improvement, or assumed improvement, of 3% between the years 1999 and 2000 at the age 60. We can immediately see that whilst improvements are relatively high now, they tail away fairly quickly, both with time and with age. This is a result of the targeted nature of the 92 series projections, i.e. they assume that there's a natural limit to both mortality rates and life expectancy. Although the 92 series improvements are age and time dependent, they assume that mortality rates cannot fall below a certain lower limit. This lower limit was defined in terms of percentage of the rates seen in 1992, and in particular, percentage of the base 1992 table. Critically, at older ages, this limit was taken to be quite high. For example, mortality rates at age 80 were assumed to only ever to be able to fall to around about half of the level they were in 1992. And at older ages still, at ages, say, 90, the mortality rates were only assumed to be able to fall by a third. The speed of convergence to these limits also varies with age, with a significant proportion of the convergence happening before 2012, i.e. only a few years hence. This means that by using the 92 projections, actuarial valuations are implicitly assuming a lower level of long-term improvements in successive valuations. In reality, many valuations will be also making an allowance for the accelerated improvements observed during those amongst those retiring during the 1990s. This is known as the cohort effect, and effectively introduces a ridge of more rapid improvements into the chart we saw earlier. For the interim cohort projections, this ridge relates to the generation born between 1910 and 1941. I will not dwell on these cohort projections, although I've summarised the key points on screen as a reference material for those who download the presentation from the profession's website after the session. Suffice to say, the key unknown was, and still is, how long this generation will continue to experience more rapid improvements. With this background in mind, I turn to the question of projecting mortality. In terms of using the 92 series and interim cohort projections, I consider this as being in two parts. The long-term trend, for which we're reliant on the 92 series projections, and selecting a length of time for which the cohort generation will continue to experience more rapid improvements. And I'll phrase this in terms of two particular questions on screen. The focus of this presentation is on the first question, in particular asking what allowance should be made for general improvements, and does this imply that an underpin should be used to the level of improvements commonly adopted? Now, the projections working party of the CMI Mortality Committee has been investigating a number of new techniques and new methods for projecting mortality, and these essentially project trends in historic data to answer these two questions simultaneously. In many ways, the question of applying a minimum level to improvements can therefore be seen as an interim measure until these new techniques are readily available. Now, I shall return to this point briefly at the end of the presentation. However, my starting point for considering general improvements is to actually look at life expectancy rather than mortality rates. Why have I chosen to do this? Well, the first reason is that of communication. Trustees of pension schemes are required to adopt prudent assumptions for the purposes of funding. Company directors are generally required to use best estimate assumptions for accounting purposes. I would argue that our clients are more likely to have an opinion as to whether or not a particular life expectancy is prudent or best estimate than individual mortality rates. Secondly, life expectancy is actually highlighted in the Pension Regulator's Code of Practice, which states that particular attention should be paid to the assumption about future mortality. Here, experiences of a sustained trend in one direction, that of longer life expectancy. Thirdly, when assessed from retirement, life expectancy also represents the length of time for which pension schemes will pay benefits. In current times of low net discount rates, it also is a good proxy to the item ultimately of concern, the annuity value. Excuse me. This means that life expectancy represents the big picture. It enables us to step back from the detailed trends in mortality rates and look at the impact of our projections. This is not to say that trends in mortality rates should be ignored, merely that life expectancy helps us to view our projections through the eyes of our clients. With this in mind, I will be focusing on projecting older age life expectancy. I define this to be the life expectancy from age 65, so it represents the life expectancy from a typical retirement age. In order to get a long history, I'll use period life expectancy. For any calendar year, this is calculated using the mortality rates experienced in that year. This is an objective measure which can be calculated in a mechanistic way. Unlike cohort life expectancy, which is life expectancy by year of birth, it is a quantity which can be calculated right up to the start of the 21st century. This means it captures the most recent history in improvements in longevity. And lastly, period life expectancy also has the merit that I'm effectively looking at year-on-year improvements in mortality, so a period effect. So let's start by looking at the general trend in life expectancy from age 65. The chart on screen is the England and Wales life expectancy for 65-year-olds starting in 1841 and going through to 2003. And if anyone's straining their eyes to read the text at the bottom of the screen, that's purely a necessary data source citation. I've looked at England and Wales data as it provides a long history, and in particular it's indicative of general trends in mortality and longevity improvements. Now suppose for one moment you were to show this chart to a client. Now I can imagine a client looking at this chart for a few minutes and then saying, well, there's been a period back in the 19th century where life expectancy didn't really increase. And then since then, we see the sustained trend referred to in the code of practice. Now, I can easily imagine how a client might extrapolate this trend. Over the next few slides, I'll pursue this line of thought and its implications for our projections. We know, though, that mortality and life expectancy is sex-dependent, and the above chart is actually the unisex life expectancy. So let's look at men and women in turn. It turns out that the trend in female life expectancy is very similar to that which we saw at the national level. And I apologise here, I will be using, for purposes of brevity, national level to refer to England and Wales. In particular, we can see looking at females, there's a period of very constant life expectancy up until the turn of the 20th century. And from then onwards, life expectancy has increased, and it's been remarkably linear in nature. Since I'm looking at the underlying trend in improvements, I wish to avoid any unnecessary distortions from the more rapid improvements owing to the cohort generation. Now, at the national level, the cohort generation started later and relates to those born between 1925 and 1945. So for the purposes of this analysis, I effectively need to exclude the data points from around about 1995 onwards. Fitting the simple trend described earlier, we see that female life expectancy from age 65 was around about 11 years and 6 months up until the turn of the 20th century. Since then, it's been increasing at around about 26 days per annum, or 1 year for every 14. Before we move on, I'd just like to draw your attention to the most recent data points. These have a propensity to lie above the overall trend line. This suggests that the current trend, even excluding the cohort effect, is faster than historic levels. And so any improvements derived by looking back at the very long historic trend may be an understatement. But firstly, let's extrapolate this trend into the future and see how this compares to the 92 series projections. And effectively, by excluding the cohort data points, we've reduced the problem to comparing the projected trend in life expectancy from age 65 to the life expectancy under successive calendar year tables. Overlaying the 92 series calendar year tables, that's the red line, starting with PFA 92C2006 on the left, going through to PFA C2050 on the far right, we can see that after some initial divergence, the 92 series converges towards the national trend. Once we reach the 2020s, the 92 series is suggesting... the 92 series is suggesting a lower rate of year-on-year improvements in life expectancy than the sustained trend seen throughout virtually the entirety of the 20th century. In terms of the subject of this presentation, a simple and pragmatic way of avoiding this potential anomaly is to subject the rate of annual improvement in mortality to a minimum value. This simplistic approach has the dual advantages that the resultant tables are easy to calculate and that the approach is very simple to communicate, indeed to the extent that our clients are likely to understand it as a simplification. And as this is a simple approach, I've considered the level of improvement at 0.25% intervals. This was purely designed to avoid spurious accuracy. Now we can see that underpinning improvements at 0.75% per annum, starting with the improvement in the year between the years 2006 and 2007, will ensure increases in life expectancy at least keep pace with the national trend. And in fact, we see a slightly faster rate of improvement given that the two lines, dotted lines, diverge. In contrast, if we were to apply a mere 0.5% underpin, the resultant line would actually be barely divergent from the basic 92 series projections. So to be very clear about what I'm suggesting here, Once the projected mortality improvements reach 0.75%, I'm preventing them falling any further, independent of both age and time. What about males? Unfortunately, men are, in this context, slightly more awkward than women. However, we might look at this chart and consider the following. Once again, a period of probably stagnation in life expectancy during the 19th century. Quite a bit of fluctuation, but that's not surprising given the small numbers of individuals actually attaining age 65. This was followed by a subsequent period of slight increase before further stagnation in the 1950s and 60s. And then a period of what looks to be vaguely linear increases since 1970. We can fit such a form to the data, and indeed I have done so. However, for the purposes of this session, I will show you the part relating to the most recent trend, i.e. from 1950 onwards. Looking at this, it's very apparent that the increases since 1970 are especially linear once we exclude those data points which might have been distorted by the cohort effect. Fitting a simple trend to this, we see that life expectancy, or period life expectancy from age 65, was around about 12 years in the 1950s and 1960s, and since then has been increasing at around about 41 days per annum. Using a similar approach to women, we compare the 92 series projections to the extrapolation of the current national trend. This gives rise to a rapid convergence of the 92 series with the projected trend, i.e. the 92 series projections fall well short of the 41 days per annum increase in life expectancy being seen at the national level. To broadly mirror these increases, a higher minimum level of improvements would be needed for men as compared to women, at a level of roughly 1.25% per annum. This actually gives a slightly slower rate of increase in life expectancy than the national trend. In the context of determining a prudent assumption for funding purposes, this may suggest that trustees would want to use a higher level of improvement than the value shown on screen. And we can look at a slightly higher level of increase. At 1.5%, we can see a clear divergence between the two lines, some more rapid increases in life expectancy. And for completeness, you might be wondering what the 1% level looks like. And this shows considerably slower increases than the population as a whole. Now, you might be wondering what these trends are assuming about the relative difference in life expectancy between men and women. For example, am I assuming that at some point in the future, men will outlive women? The solid line in this chart plots the history of difference in female and male life expectancy from age 65 over time. And we see there's been a very discernible hump in this chart. The difference between males and females was that women outlived men by about 9 months back in the 19th century, but this reached a peak of 4 years in the late 70s and the early 1980s. The dotted line is based on the extrapolation. The dotted line is based on the extrapolated trend we saw earlier for men and women. We can see that by the time we reach 2050, I'm not assuming that men outlive women. Far from it. There's actually a 1 year difference in life expectancy still. We also need to check whether, when we apply a different level of minimum improvements to men and women, whether or not we'll end up with difference in life expectancies and men outliving women then. For these purposes, it makes sense to look at cohort life expectancies, i.e. those based on an individual's year of birth. These allow for the different levels of improvements in mortality for men and women up to both up to age 65 and the years thereafter. Using the improvements of 1.25% and 0.75% suggested earlier gives a very comforting picture. Now, so far, I've considered a pragmatic practitioner's view and approach to deducing an underpin to future mortality improvements. There are a number of reasons why individual actuaries might come to different conclusions than I have, and I'll briefly survey these. For example, I've focused on life expectancy from age 65. In practice, members in different pension schemes may retire at different ages, or you may be most concerned with the retired members of a pension scheme, so older ages. I've also looked at the big picture, but ultimately this is a simplification of underlying trends in mortality rates. And I've obviously assumed that the past is a guide to the future, and doing this in isolation can be dangerous. So starting with life expectancies at different ages, we can repeat the analysis of life expectancies seen earlier for a number of different ages, and the table on screen summarises this. And you may notice I've omitted the results for males from age 55, and this is because I can't differentiate between the long-term trend and the cohort effects there. They start too similar a period of point in time. Now, we can immediately see that the conclusion as to level of underpin is not particularly sensitive to retirement age. And this is hardly surprising, as life expectancy is actually most sensitive to mortality rates between the ages 75 and 90, a point I will return to in a minute. However, looking at older ages, we can see that perhaps there may be some kind of underlying age structure, which I've simplified by purely looking at life expectancies. This might lead us to question the simplicity of using a single underpin. For example, perhaps an age-dependent underpin would be more appropriate. To understand more about the trends, we need to look at the last 40 years in more detail. And once we do this and start looking at the year-on-year improvements in mortality rates, we start seeing there's considerable variation. To smooth out this variation, we need to effectively focus in on key ages and look at moving averages over time. Doing this will give a chart similar to the one on screen. Here the solid lines, the blue, red and black, represent five-year age groups from ages 75 through to 90. And these represent the ages where the survival curve in retirement rapidly tails off, i.e. those ages to which post-retirement life expectancy and so annuity values are currently most sensitive. And for completeness, I've included the adjacent five-year age bands as the dotted lines. It's important to note that this chart has not been distorted in any way by the cohort effect, since at the national level, the cohort generation will only enter the 70 to 74-year-old age band in the year 2000. Now, the chart shows a number of interesting features. The first is that there's a clear trend for increasing levels of improvements. It suggests that if recent historic trends were to continue into the future, then a rate of improvement derived from historic experience may underestimate future improvements. In particular, if trustees or sponsors are seeking an assumption whereby improvements continue at the most recent levels, then an annual rate of improvement closer to 2% might be more appropriate. The rates of improvement do seem to have a clear age structure, with higher rates at the younger ages and lower rates at the older ages. However, perhaps the 1.25% that I derived earlier can be considered to be a broad average of the period in question. For women, the improvements over the last 40 years have averaged at around about 1% per annum, again, broadly consistent with the number I gave earlier. This particular chart also shows an interesting feature, the ageing of mortality improvements. We can see this by looking at the 80 to 84-year-old age band, the red line. At times, this has actually been higher than the level of improvement seen for those amongst 75 and 79-year-olds. This is important. As individuals live longer, so the emphasis shifts to improving mortality and morbidity at the older ages, with the most rapid improvements occurring at gradually older ages. This observation was one of the many features of trends in mortality rates identified by a cross-board working party, which presented the paper Longevity in the 21st Century, here at Staple Inn some 3 years ago. That paper provides a far more comprehensive analysis of trends in mortality rates than I could possibly do here. And it includes analysis of the trends by cause of death. However, the far more detailed analysis contained in that paper has verified a number of the observations I've already made. For example, this is an extract from that paper. And this looks at the annual level of mortality improvement between 1960 and 2001 for men and women. Firstly, we see a verification of the age structure to improvements, decreasing with age. We can see that the 1.25% I suggested earlier is broad average of these values. And we can certainly see there's a degree of stability across the age groups for women. However, the table on screen also suggests potentially a higher level of improvements for females than I gave. And this is not surprising given my earlier observation that female life expectancy seems to have been increasing more rapidly over recent years than over the long term. With this in mind, it's important to consider whether or not the past is truly a guide to the future. And the particular quotation on screen is one that's commonly cited in such debates. It's from Professor J. Olshansky at the University of Chicago. And Professor Olshansky speaks of a storm approaching, and we should be cognizant of this. In particular, if we believe Professor Olshansky's words, we may wish to modify improvements downwards. For example, if our best estimate is that of a series of medical challenges which will set back mortality improvements. But equally, we may wish to modify our underpin upwards if we can identify a wave of future improvements. So perhaps to introduce this topic, let's have a little look at how we've achieved the mortality rates we now see. Now, there are two parallel theories or transitions which describe how we've reached current low levels of mortality. The first is the health transition, which relates to improvements in public health. The second is the epidemiological transition, which relates to specific causes of death. And the graphic on screen is a plotted history of how these two transitions have led to the substantial declines in mortality throughout Western Europe and the rest of the globe. Now, the two key areas to highlight are where we are at in each of these transitions. In terms of public health, much of the recent improvements in mortality are attributable to rapid economic developments, and for instance, the affordability of healthcare and investment in biomedicine. In terms of specific diseases, we can see how the focus has shifted over time, essentially between the big killers of the day, starting with communicable diseases, through respiratory diseases, to the current day, where it's cardiovascular disease, which is taking centre stage. And this is illustrated in the following table. This table shows the progress in mortality improvements over the last 30 years, and in particular, the number of males over age 75 dying per 10,000 of such males in 1970 and 2000. And it's split out by the major causes of death. And this particular table shows us the incredible progress that's been made battling cardiovascular disease in recent decades. Cancers and respiratory diseases are equivalent killers to cardiovascular disease. So any improvement in any one of these three offers scope for continued and accelerated improvements in mortality. Is this possible? Well, looking at the aggregate level of deaths, this is high compared to international comparators. In longevity in the 21st century, the authors have highlighted, for example, that at age 75, mortality rates in the UK are some 40% higher than international lows, that's for males, and it's some 70% higher for females. At this point, I'd like to briefly introduce two topical issues, which I'm sure will come up in the discussion. The first is smoking and the second is obesity. In the paper, The Cohort Effect, Insights and Explanations, Richard Willetts identified smoking trends as a contributing factor to the cohort effect. The proportion of the population who smoke has fallen to historic lows. However, 25% of the adult population are still smokers, so perhaps we need to be alert to the forthcoming ban in public smoking in public places, as this may herald a future wave of improvements. Obesity has been identified as an independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease, currently the big killer. Amongst adults, it's been shown to have a material impact on the probability of premature death, and so on adults' life expectancy. This could lead us to revise downwards any estimate of a minimum level to mortality improvements. However, premature death is often defined in terms of death before a certain age, for example, age 70. And this perhaps could suggest that whilst pre-retirement mortality rates may be increased by obesity, perhaps the same can't be said for post-retirement mortality rates. And indeed, perhaps we should question the extent to which life expectancy will be impacted once individuals reach retirement age. One way we can do this is to compare the trends in old age life expectancy between England and Wales in nations around the world which have a long history of obesity. Now, I've produced analysis similar to that seen earlier for England and Wales, but for the USA. And this suggests that the long-term improvements in national life expectancy are running at very similar levels in the United States. For men, it's about 3 days per annum slower than here in the UK. However, it's also very noticeable that the USA has seen far less of a cohort effect than the UK. And it may be the case that obesity has played some part in this, and I feel this was certainly something worthy of further investigation. So what are the implications of applying a minimum level to mortality improvements? Well, to be clear, what I'm suggesting as an interim solution is that we continue to use the 92 series improvements. We make some allowance for the cohort effect, but we also make an allowance for continuation of general improvements in mortality, general improvements in longevity, via a non-zero minimum level to mortality improvements. And I see this very much as an interim step with the new techniques that are on the horizon, and I'll look at those in a moment. But first, I'd like to just pause and look at the implications for pension scheme valuations. The chart on screen compares valuation annuities for males using medium cohort projections with a variety of different minimum levels of improvement. And it compares the relative value of those annuities to a baseline of purely medium cohort with no minimum level of improvement. I've looked at four different levels of minimum improvement. The bottom line is a 1%, then there's a 1.25%, the blue line. Above that's a 1.5%, and finally a 2%. Now, recall I identified earlier that the 0.25% fell slightly short of maintaining the national trends, whilst 1.5% was slightly faster. Also, 2% was the current very recent level of improvements. Finally, I've included as a dotted line the relative annuity values under long cohort without any level of minimum improvements. And for the record, by a valuation annuity, I mean a single life annuity of attaching 50% contingent life annuity based upon a spouse's pension of 50% of the members and a MAD assumption of 90%. Throughout this analysis, a net discount rate of 2% has been used, and the same underpin has been applied to mortality improvements for both men and women, and that's purely for simplicity. And in all cases, the annuities have been calculated using a year of use approach to mortality. Now, although the decision as to the level of underpin and the length of time for which the cohort will last are separate considerations, we can see that for all of the levels of underpin looked at here, the annuity values are considerably lower relative to medium cohort than long cohort. This means that for current pensioners, the decision as to how long the cohort effect will continue for is likely to be more important than the decision as to what level of underpin to apply. However, when we look at future retirees, the compounding effect of any minimum level of improvement means that the decision as to that level can have a material impact. Indeed, it's likely to be at least as material, if not more so, than the decision as to what length of cohort to allow for. To quantify this, let's consider the example of a 1.25% underpin. This would increase the present value of benefit obligations by around about 1-2% for pensioners, and around about 5% for actives and deferreds. It would increase the cost of benefits accruing by around about 5%. And if carried through to the calculation of transfer values on a expected cost approach, it would increase payments by around about 2% for those deferred members closest to retirement and 12% for the youngest deferreds. In addition, if used, for example, for defined contribution pots and the projections of the pensions that members will get from them, it would also result in a material decline or decrease in the projected pension payment. And perhaps lastly, we should note that applying any kind of minimum level of improvements will increase the duration of the pension scheme liabilities. So if a pension scheme has a liability-driven investment strategy, for example, this may require some adjustments. I mentioned earlier that the CMI is currently looking at a number of new techniques for identifying the underlying trends in mortality improvements and projecting these into the future. And I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, will have heard of the P-spline and Lee Carter methods. Now, the approach I've looked at is deliberately simplistic, and so it's worth considering how it might compare to where we'll end up in the future. I think this is an important point, since our clients have effectively been hit by increases in life expectancy at a number of successive valuations. The chart on screen contrasts the male cohort life expectancy, so based upon an individual's year of birth, from age 65 under each of the following assumptions. Firstly, using medium cohort projections. That's the bottom line. Secondly, the blue line, the second line up. This is the same projections, but subject to improvements of a minimum of 1.25%, starting with the improvements between 2006 and 2007. And lastly, an example projection where I've taken the calendar year 2006 table with medium cohort improvements between 1992 and 2006 and applied some example P-spline improvements to that. And I think the last of these lines shows a dramatic improvement over and above both current medium cohort assumptions and what I'm proposing here. And in part, this is due to the projection being influenced by the more rapid recent improvements. However, this does remind me of two things. Firstly, that the improvements I've suggested so far might turn out to be lower than reality if current trends continue. And secondly, the importance of conveying the uncertainty in these projections, perhaps via illustrating results on a variety of different minimum levels or a variety of projection techniques. So, to sum up, the original 92 series projections give life expectancies at older ages which do not keep pace with historic trends. One simple pragmatic solution is to subject those mortality improvements to a single minimum value at all ages. And historic trends in life expectancy might suggest a value of 0.75% for that minimum for women and 1.25% for men. However, ultimately, this does simplify an underlying age structure to mortality improvements. Further, wider considerations, such as the scope for medical improvements or the socioeconomic profile of a particular population of a pension scheme that we're looking at, might lead to individual actuaries, trustees and sponsors arriving at a different conclusion. And at which point, I'd be very interested in hearing the views of those in the audience.
Right, now it's your turn then. The discussion is open to the floor. Now, can I first of all ask for an indication of those who might be minded to speak in the discussion. Could you? Oh, quite a few. Good. Okay, well, I've got two names, and I'll start with those. But before I do that, I should make one or two further announcements. Please don't let the fact that the meeting is being recorded deter you from contributing, as speakers will be given the opportunity to see their comments before they're published in the BAJ. I'm not sure that that opportunity extends to the webcast, unfortunately. If time doesn't allow you to make your full comments, then you can submit a written contribution after the meeting. And roving microphones are available if you'd like to speak from the main body of the hall. And since we don't actually have a lectern, that seems to be the main option this evening. And finally, can you please state your name clearly before speaking? So can I ask Richard Humble to make the first contribution, and then after him, James Tooley.
Thank you, President. My name is Richard Humble. I just wish to stress that the comments that I make are my own and do not necessarily reflect the views of my office. Firstly, I would like to congratulate the presenter on his most interesting, very timely presentation on this this important subject. My remarks are from those of a life office actuary rather than a pension scheme perspective. Looked at from that way, I think it's important to make a distinction between two very different situations. One is where one is considering the appropriateness of a minimum level of improvement in the context of the rest of the improvements being considered to be realistic. And the second is where an office, for reasons of public presentation, may state its basis as being a particular cohort assumption coupled with a flaw of improvements, but may regard the underlying cohort assumption as being prudent. Taking the first situation where the other levels of improvement assumption are considered to be realistic, I must say that I am not aware of any evidence to support the contention that improvements trend to zero as the 92 projections, which ultimately end up being what occurs in the long term under the cohort methodology, imply. Members may well be aware of the work of Jim Open and James Vopal in this area. In particular, their article in Science magazine in 2002 entitled Broken Limits to Life Expectancy. Indeed, Jim Open, in a presentation jointly with the ILC made in this hall in 2003, a very impressive account of their work in this area. They analysed the trend in life expectancy over time of the country in the world which at that particular time had the highest life expectancy. Not only did they not find that it levelled out to a constant as implied by the 92 projections, but that it continued to increase at a constant rate of 0.25% per annum over a period of a quarter of a year per annum over a period of 160 years. So I think any suggestion of life expectancy levelling out at some point really must be extremely seriously questioned. Notwithstanding this historical data, I entirely agree with the presenter that there may be other factors which lead to mortality slowing or even going into reverse. There's been much press publicity about the possibility of virulent strains of influenza. And indeed, in recent years, we've had some quite near misses on the mortality front. We were very lucky that the AIDS virus proved to be so fragile that it was not easily transmitted by basically touching door handles or something. And in the case of SARS, we were extremely lucky that that infection was symptomatic before it became infectious, in stark contrast to the cold or flu. Obesity was also mentioned, and I think this is an important factor. I think as regards the situation in the UK, the US may perhaps be different in this regard. I think the impact on annuities currently in payment is likely to be rather limited, but looking longer term, this undoubtedly can be a most important factor. So, I think if one is looking at a sort of realistic basis, there seems to be no argument for not having a significant flaw as part of that basis. However, returning to the second situation I described, where an office chooses to publish or present its results on the basis of some combination of cohort with a flaw, and may have its own internal model on which it is basing its assumptions, but does not wish to publish that model, there may be no inconsistency if it considers the particular cohort assumption being adopted conservative, why it may not consider having a lower flaw or even no flaw at all, provided that may result in reserves being at a level consistent with its base internal assumption. The sort of reason which might lead one to take the view that the particular cohort methodology being published on may include elements of conservatism is, as the presenter has indicated, there is a significant view that a major contributory factor to some of the cohort improvements, particularly amongst males, are a consequence of changes in the prevalence of smoking. And notwithstanding statistics relating to the relative proportion of smokers, I think if you look at the statistics in more detail, you'll find that a high percentage of current smokers tend to be young, and that people tend to give up smoking as they get older, and that the reduction in smoking prevalence amongst people at older ages has been very marked over the sort of period, sort of 74 to the current time, which is when the ONS statistics covering this are available, and that therefore changes in the prevalence of smoking may be a considerable contributory factor to the cohort effect, and it may not be realistic to forward project those improvements at that level. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. Is James Tooley? Yes, he's there.
Mr. President, my name is James Tooley. Again, I'm speaking from a life insurance view. And again, I'd very much like to thank the presenter for an extremely interesting presentation this evening. I also think that the analysis of statistics, as the previous speaker, is extremely important in judging potential futures for this very important topic that covers both our pension practice area and our life practice area. But I fear the study of statistics on its own will be eventually rather unrewarding, in the sense of it does not bring us to a clear view of the whys and wherefores of the future. and that we need to perhaps spend rather more time looking at the medical science and the drivers of mortality into the future so that we can better understand what is a plausible future and what medical science being reported today on the front pages of our papers could actually mean for our annuity books. I suspect that work is going on in various large life offices and pension consultancies, but it perhaps needs to be more published and more open to give credibility to us as a profession that we know quite a lot about longevity. Speaking as a regulator on behalf of Mr. Tower, your guest up the front, we necessarily have a very deep interest in the views of the profession and the research the profession undertakes in this important area. And I suppose we start from the basis that any statistic, longevity, that is deeply uncertain on just its best estimate requires a high degree of caution when you come to set prudence or stress, as you do in the life insurance arena, for Pillar 1 liabilities and for Pillar 2 capital. So our view is that not to have some sort of minimum improvement factor looks extremely bullish in that sort of context where you are in fact unsure of the best estimate position. And we would be looking for very robust science and reasoning behind anything that looked like medium cohort with no improvement factors beyond those already in the table, acknowledging the previous speaker that you could get your margins in a rather different way in any case. And I think that leads one on to pricing. The bulk annuity market at the moment is quite fierce in terms of its pricing, and again from a regulatory point of view that is the shareholders' issue or problem. Provided there is good capital there, customers will be safe. But bullish or aggressive pricing markets in any branch of insurance do not justify weak reserving standards. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James. Now, who would like to make the next contribution? Yes. Paul Greenwood.
I support Stephen's work. He's drawn attention to an issue I've personally become very concerned about in the last 9 months, of whether on the pension side, especially for final salary schemes, we've closed memberships with a substantial proportion of pensioners from the cohort generations, whether MC reserving was enough. I personally come to the view that it wasn't. I think Stephen's conclusions are very similar. I do support his logic of some minimum level. My own conclusions is that, in addition to that, based on what's happening over the last 2 or 3 years, the rate of improvement for the cohort generations seems to be increasing slightly rather than falling away. So unfortunately, I suspect we need to do something in addition. My concern is the time to correct this under-reserving we've got is very short, both with schemes shutting and with the period left before substantially the whole of the cohort generation is in retirement. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. And the next contribution. Come on, there are lots of people who know a lot about this subject in the audience. Some of you must want to say something.
Brian's up there.
Oh, yes.
He's obviously walking down.
All right. Okay, he's not coming. We don't need to restrict the discussion to the specific question which Stephen asked in the title of his presentation. I think any matters relating to projection of mortality improvements are within the scope of this discussion. Brian.
Thank you, President. Yes, the question was raised a couple of questions ago about looking at the issues of drivers in medical science and other areas. So I thought I'd just draw attention to one or two of the areas where the profession is working on that at present. Firstly, there's the Actuaries Panel on Medical Advances, set up some years ago. It set out its major project that it's running at the moment is called Modelling the Demographic and Financial Effects of Medical Advances. And it takes the issue that if we can find a way of modelling the impact of a particular medical advance, for example, on coronaries or strokes, and then we can track that through to the improvements in mortality, then we should then be able to test a variety of scenarios, both on the past, to find out whether we have the scenario right, and then project that forward to the future. That's a fairly major bit of work being sponsored by the profession and by one of the research councils. It's being run in Heriot-Watt, and it's due to report this year. So that'll be a really interesting report when it comes. There's a major research project that's been funded by the profession as a starter, and still I think has to get its full set of funding. Being run by University College London, and it's entitled The Contribution of Medical Advancements to Mortality Improvements from 1970 to 2000. And the intention there is to test a variety of models to measure the impacts of factors such as medical advances, behavioural changes, material changes, and socio-political issues on longevity. And one of the things they will do, which could be really interesting if they can get it as a result of this, would be to produce tables of contributions showing the estimated reduction in population death rates resulting from each of the different developments. Still requires the major funding, and let's hope it can get it. Running at this precise moment over the coming 6 months, and we had a steering group meeting this afternoon chaired by the chairman of the research committee, is a scoping mortality research project. And the concept in there is that there are a variety of different disciplines tackling mortality in different areas, and we're not sure we know too much about them. Obviously, some tremendous work done in the paper Longevity in the 21st Century to look at improvements in mortality from a multidisciplinary angle and to look at the potential for the future. But this one is aiming to take a really wide view on what's happening in the other disciplines and to come up with a sort of scoping study that might produce, if possible, a two-dimensional plan that shows where gerontologists, other medics, health economists, demographers, and a variety of other people are working in the field of mortality and how they interrelate and whether there are any gaps. And the idea is to try and find those gaps and focus possibly future research, multidisciplinary, on those areas. So those are three areas that are being worked on by members of the profession and funded by the profession. I know there are a variety of others, and it might be interesting to look at that because I think we're coming to the conclusion that as was stated by the original speaker, looking at the past to develop the future has its limitations. And if nothing else, if you could find a way of calibrating your past projections with future ideas of where mortality might go, you might get a feeling for whether you're going in the right direction in developing a future projection. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brian. Right, who's going to go next? Yes, Nigel.
Mr. President, thank you. My name's Nigel Bankhead for the Board for Actuarial Standards. I should start by saying that mortality is not a matter the board has considered in depth to date, but I think it's true to say that it will undoubtedly fall into our arena at some stage in the future. We're well aware of that and have had certain discussions on that to date. For today's question, though, is just a slightly looking ahead, looking at some of the issues I think we should ask ourselves when we come to look at the matter of particularly longevity. And I took tonight's question, which was phrased, should mortality improvements be subject to a minimum value? And I actually changed it slightly to see what I came up with. And I substituted the words, should mortality improvements be subject to an arbitrary value? And that somehow in itself seemed a lot less attractive. And it led me on to consider the question, well, why in actual fact would that be necessary to even go down that line of thought? And I think it comes down to this very first question, which is a key one. Can longevity itself be reliably forecast? That seems to me to be the key question. If the answer to that is yes, it's quite simple, we should do so. If the answer to that is no, we should probably say so. So that's question number one, which I think is quite key. The second issue, though, is to look at longevity itself and ask what it represents. If the future regarding longevity is not certain, it must represent a risk. The question is, what sort of risk is that it represents? Is it a diversifiable risk? So by holding enough of that exposure, it would revert to the mean, or is it non-diversifiable? Now, it seems to me it probably is a non-diversifiable risk. So whatever your expectation, by holding more of that risk, you've got concentration. You're not dispersing the risk. So if you then came round and said, well, what measures do you have for covering risk? If it's a non-diversifiable risk, you could say, well, let's try and cover that in the measure. But even that itself may not be successful. And I think you'd come back to the answer that if you're facing a non-diversifiable risk, the answer to that is going to be the whole capital. Outcomes in the future may vary, and that would be the method of providing security. No, I think I'll stop there. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Right, who would like to make the next contribution? Yes, Roy.
President, the name's Roy Coburn. I've reached the age when reminders of my personal mortality come with ever-increasing frequency. And I remember a lady saying to me, some years ago, that old age seldom comes alone, and as one gets older, one appreciates the meaning of this. The point of that is that there was a piece in the FT magazine this weekend where attributed to David Blake, where he was saying that our grandchildren, I'm not sure whether that means mine or the grandchildren of what might be my grandchildren, might live to 160, whereas it seems to me that the human body begins to deteriorate and there must be an ultimate limit, and some of these projections seem to be rather ignoring that fact. When people project trends, lay people, I tend to say that actuaries absorb with their mother's milk the dangers of extrapolation, and we have a presentation tonight which seems to depend to me entirely on extrapolation. And therefore, I regard the graphs that have been put up on the board as highly dangerous, and that we could be in the situation of being over-anxious. You invited us, President, to widen this if we felt like it. And one thing strikes me, as people get older, there are more and more expensive medical treatments to prolong age. And at some time, there must be a limit to what the country can afford to spend on this. Similarly, from presentations in this hall, we have seen that the full expectation is increasing faster than the healthy life expectation. I find that very disturbing, and it does seem to mean that more and more state costs are going to be spent on keeping people going who need great care. I mean, I don't know when it will happen, but sometime governments have got to address these issues and deal with the cost, and they themselves could even have some effect on life expectation.
Thank you, Roy. Yes, Robin.
Robin Houghton. I'd like to pick up on some of the comments made by the previous gentleman here. When I saw the graphs extrapolating and coming up with the sort of the baselines, I thought to myself, we have a trend in the past which was flat. Then we had a step change, it moved to increasing. And then you extrapolated that increasing trend. Why wouldn't there be another step change in the future? It could have happened already in the past, but we haven't got enough evidence to actually see that step change. So it almost seems a little bit arbitrary, as the comment we had earlier, to use the past trend to say what the level should be in the future. Another comment I'd like to make is on the medium cohort, where fundamentally we've got this ridge of faster mortality improvements, and it's the younger ages really which don't have it rapid enough improvements, and whether your floor minimum value is the correct level to use for them, who knows? I think it's far too subjective just to apply a floor into the future where there could be big changes in the future, step changes that we haven't yet evidenced or seen. So I prefer more to see some of the sort of the piece blind sort of methods applied, some of the more statistically valid methods, until we can actually pull in the medical profession and get their sensible comment on this very interesting subject.
Thank you very much, Robin. Right, who would like to go next? Yes, Robert, down here.
Thank you, Mr. President. I plead guilty again to being an insurance actuary and one who fears to tread in pension schemes arena occasionally.
You have to give your name.
It's Robert Hall, to apologise. I just thought it might be worth noting that the use of minimum improvement factors by insurers is to some extent in the public domain, and just feed that into the discussion, that as at 31st December 2005, the bulk of large annuity providers were using minimum improvement factors of between about 0.6 and 2% per annum for males, and 0.6 and 1.5 for females. Now, this is in the public domain. It is only the basis that's used for mathematical reserves, and hence is intended to be prudent. But just from experience, this does tend to feed through into pricing, and hence the pricing for bulk buyouts, which in turn would be relevant in a pension schemes environment to Section 75 debts, increasingly things such as IAS 19 disclosures and indeed funding disclosures more generally, and perhaps may also be of relevance to technical memorandum number one. In view of the speaker's mentioning at outset that he was a practitioner and taking it from a practitioner's viewpoint, I do wonder whether that is some evidence to support further evidence to support the use of minimum improvement factors. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. Right. Can we have another contribution? Yes, there's a hand towards the back. Sorry?
Somebody just came in the door.
Oh, right, yes, okay.
My name's Colin Wilson.
I'd like to pick up on the question that Nigel asked earlier about, can longevity be accurately forecast? I think most of us would agree. I think the actuarial profession has in fact answered that question by saying no, it can't. And hence the CMI Bureau has said it is no longer appropriate to publish any standard improvement factors for use, and it, therefore actuaries will have to come up with their own assessments here. So we recognise that there can be no accurate forecasts. Nevertheless, we all have to come up with some basis for assessing reserves, assessing prices and other such factors. So hence the sort of statistical results that we've been looking at this evening. But clearly, as has also been said, there are limits here. If we start to look towards medical improvements, well, that's one thing. But actually, as I think another speaker effectively indicated, there comes a point where it's no longer about medical advances. It's a political decision about how long people will live because of the amount of money that it will take to prolong their life. So there then becomes a question, I think, as to whether that political decision is itself affected by the sorts of things that actuaries do. For example, I'm thinking the more of this risk that is picked up by the private sector, where the government perhaps can think it's a risk that can be ignored from their perspective, that itself could have a knock-on effect on what the outcomes will actually be. I don't think there's anything helpful in what I've said, except to say it's a very difficult question.
Very good, thank you. Yes, at the back.
My name is Joseph Liu. I congratulate the speaker for tackling such a difficult question. And one question I keep asking myself is how reasonable these projections are. It doesn't matter what projection we use, MC, with a floor, with a minimum or not. And I think there have been developments in the demographic arena where they look at the age structure, of mortality. One example is the Gompers. Will this projection satisfy these we already know about age structures like Gompers law, as well as law convergence at older ages? And there are also questions about asymptotic mortality. Is there a minimum level at these ages where people who say that there are only two certainties in life, is death and tax. So are we going to come to a level where it will become unreasonable? And I also ask, what kind of scenarios are we projecting? Can we articulate them? Can we describe to other people in other profession? Can we say things like this will mean that X percent of heart attack can be cured, and cancer can be cured, or we can postpone death by 2 months every year? And I think we perhaps need some tools to help us visualize these future scenarios. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Jeremy Goford.
Jeremy Goford. I'd seriously recommend that those of you who can come to meetings of the International Longevity Centre that are held in this hall every couple of months or so. That people come to that who are much closer to the drivers of mortality than we are. And certainly, wholly unscientifically, I would say that the impression I've got from going to those meetings is that, in their view, longevity is increasing at a far greater rate than I've got the feeling that these numbers are showing tonight. And I would seriously recommend that. Certainly, there's a huge divergence, it seems to me, between those of us who are looking at trends and those who are looking at the drivers. And that, in itself, should be reflected in the ICA's capital and, indeed, the cost of that capital in pricing. One of the more extreme characters at the ICA, at the ILC UK meetings, is a chap called Aubrey de Grey, who some of you may know, and he runs a thing called the Methuselah Foundation. which I think is actually just him, but but he is of the view that until recently, medical science has concentrated on two things. One is keeping people alive who are already sick, and the other is trying to do things to prevent people getting sick in the first place. And he says, it's his view, that there's a third way, in the middle, which is called repairing. So you allow people to get sick, but you repair that sickness. And he draws the parallel of having a loose tile on your roof. Those who are patching up the wallpaper inside, but the rain's still coming in, and those who are growing trees around the outside to prevent the next tile coming off. But he is a repairer of tiles. Now, in his view, there are only 7 damages to be repaired, and there have not been no more than 7 discovered in the last 20 years. So it's his view there are only 7. It's also his view that a repair mechanism for all of these 7 will be available in 20 years. He therefore comes to the conclusion that the person who will live to 1,000 is already alive, because that person will only die by accident. Anyway, that's his view. I say it's extreme, love it or like it, whatever you like. But nevertheless, these views are out there, and there's a whole a breadth of other views at the International Longevity Centre meetings. But in any event, what are trustees and sponsors doing, taking not only this risk, but also this uncertainty of risk, rather than spending their time worrying about widgets, which is their business and what their shareholders gave them the capital to use? So I think this should be increasingly worrying to trustees and sponsors, and they should be dumping this uncertain risk as fast as they possibly can, getting on with making widgets.
Yes, there's a hand over.
My name's David Martin. I just want to make one very simple point. We've talked today about mortality improvements generally, without specifying perhaps which area we're looking at. Pensions has been mentioned and life has been mentioned. Most final salary pension schemes, perhaps sadly, have got a closed membership. So we're looking at a group of people who are probably over a certain age, maybe mid-30s at the youngest. Average age is increasing very, very fast. And these people are those that are connected with this cohort effect that we've been talking about. We've also heard about the effects of childhood obesity and so on, but my view is that that's likely to affect perhaps a different set of generations. And if we're looking at a different problem, which may be projections of mortality for the population as a whole, we might have different considerations there. If you look at other countries, we've heard a little bit about the States, but there are lots of other countries in the world where trends are very different. We heard about how our concerns about AIDS, thank goodness, have not come to fruition in the UK. But if you look at a country like, or countries in the south of Africa, their situation is very different. I read the other day that in Russia, because of changes in economic conditions, life expectancy is reducing. So the economic situation does affect it as well. So my point, very simply, just to summarise, is that depending on where we're looking and which group we're looking at and what problem we're trying to solve, the projection situation may be very different. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Who would like to go next? Oh, yes, Nigel.
Nigel Bodie. I'd like to start off by expressing considerable sympathy for the author's views regarding the application of a minimum rate of mortality improvement. I should point out that my recent move from a leading benefits consultancy to a leading audit firm has not had any colour in that view whatsoever. I also like to accept a fairly broad brush approach to this. I find the suggestion that we can actually project year-on-year rates of mortality improvement to several decimal places somewhat implausible.
Nonetheless, I will make a somewhat esoteric point regarding rates of mortality improvement at extreme ages. Is it appropriate to apply the same minimum rate of improvement to people at 90 or 100 as it is to people who are 65? It's making a certain statement about how fast we expect the limit to life, if indeed there is such a thing, will be pushed out. It probably doesn't have a significant effect on annuity values once you start allowing for discounting. However, expectations of life, which are clearly not discounted, we may find that this disclosable item may be affected by the extent to which we are projecting higher age longevity improvements. I think also, although it doesn't affect annuity values very much, if we do have a minimum rate of improvement, then that will affect the liabilities in respect of younger people, active members of occupational pension schemes. I gather there are a few such animals in the private sector, but I suspect it may have a more significant impact on the cost of public sector benefits. Thank you.
Thank you, Nigel. Still time for a few more contributions.
Sorry, I say something while they're having a thought.
Yes, if you don't mind. Yeah, thank you. Michael.
While you're all thinking about what you're going to say, I'll share with you one anecdote, one observation, and one request, I think. The anecdote is during the course of my presidency, I was giving a talk at a conference, and I found myself sitting at the top table before the conference started next to an elderly gentleman who introduced himself as a member of the House of Lords, and I asked him what his background was, and he said he was an economist. And he asked me what my background was, and I told him I was an actuary. He said, "Well, oh yes, you're the people who got mortality all wrong." So I started talking to him about some of the issues here very briefly, and he said, "Oh, it's very simple, really." He said, "You just take the current trends and project them forwards." And I had in my mind one of the graphs that Stephen showed, which showed that life expectancy had not only been increasing for a long time, but the rate of increase had been speeding up. And I just said to him, "Well, the difficulty with that is if you do that, we all become immortal." Then I heard about Aubrey de Grey, and I'm wondering whether maybe he might have been right and I was wrong. But it does seem to me that the rate of increase in life expectancy sometime has got to slow down. The problem is we don't know when and we don't know by how much. My observation is that around the drivers of change, it does seem to me when you look back over the last 50 years, you can identify quite easily things which must have led to an improvement in life expectancy. Fewer people smoking, improvements in medical health, the medical profession, and better lifestyle, a better understanding about things like diet and so forth. But trying to quantify those is quite difficult because you don't have a controlled population. It's quite difficult to get a controlled population to say, if we hadn't had those improvements in diet, this is what the life expectancy would have been, so that now we can measure how much it's improved. And that creates problems when we're going forward. And my request or my plea is that around the question of uncertainty and communicating uncertainty, the graphs and projections that we've got are all very nice, and as actuaries we look at them and they all look very plausible. And we mustn't be taken in by them and forget when we present our results to clients to keep reminding them about how uncertain all this is. However beguiling the projections and extrapolations of the trends and the applications of minimum values seem to us as actuaries, we must remember to keep stressing the uncertainty of all this. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much, Michael. Now, yes, there's a hand at the back.
Thanks, David Schaffer. An observation, really. the title of the talk, or the question at the top, I thought was rather cleverly ambiguous, but no one else seems to have picked up on it. It might mean, when you do a technical valuation or pricing exercise, should you use a minimum number, like a 1% floor going forwards? On the other hand, it might mean, should some sort of regulatory body be imposing a minimum on the profession, because individual actuaries who are making projections aren't doing that in a sensible or plausible way. I think most of the discussion tonight has been around the first interpretation. Is it plausible that an individual actuary ought to use a minimum? I guess I'd be interested in other people's views on whether the regulators ought to be imposing a minimum, given that there's a very wide dispersion of views, particularly in the pensions world. There seem to be a lot of pension funds using no floors in their future improvements, which seems to be moving away from what a lot of people here seem to think. So I guess I'd be asking some of the regulators, would they be considering putting a minimum floor across all actuarial projections?
Does anyone want to respond to that question? Yes. Oh, yes. David, the regulator.
David Norgrave, the pensions regulator. I mean, the short answer to that is no. But I suppose I should say a little bit more than that. I mean, I'm very grateful to have been invited here tonight to hear a really very interesting discussion, as we all grapple with an extremely difficult and imponderable subject. I suppose my overwhelming feeling about it is that even if projections are impossible to do with any degree of certainty, I mean, statistically not valid if you're a professional statistician looking at this, they have to be done. And then the question is it better to be underestimating or overestimating longevity? And that's a question which different people are going to have different views on. And of course, as a regulator, we come down on one side rather than the other. I think as professionals, the question would be, which, from the point of view of the profession, is it better for you to come down? And I suspect the criticism is more likely to be from the point of view of under-reserving or under-providing than over-reserving or over-providing. I think the other thing that we clearly need to think, and I know the Board for Actuarial Standards and the Institute are thinking about, is who owns this question? You know, where the question is, how long are people going to live? I'm not myself convinced that the answer to that question is yet clear. The question of who owns the question. But I do believe it does need to be owned, not necessarily by one institution on its own, but together we have got to work out a way of coming to not a consensus that leads to one single answer necessarily, but a set of views which then can be taken forward, however uncertain they are.
Thank you very much, David. Oh, Lawrence Churchill. Very good.
Hi, Lawrence Churchill. I just wanted to add my perspective both to Nigel Bankhead's remarks and also to David Norgrove's, because it does seem to me that where you can't predict something exactly, then you should treat it as a risk factor. And the question then is about what spread of risk are you going to consider? What stress test are you going to apply? What difference does it make? What answer you come out with? And I'm afraid, as Jeremy was just remarking to me in the margins before, the elephant in the room might be how well capitalised are occupational pension schemes. Because as my life coach used to say to me whenever I was in a spot of bother with my personal life, how would money solve this problem? And I think it has a contribution to make. But of course that leads us into the Solvency II area and so on, and some very, very difficult practical issues for the UK, given the heritage that we're coming from.
Thank you very much, Lawrence. Right, we've still got time for a few more contributions. Yes, Gordon. Oh, Gordon Sharp there.
Gordon Sharp. I just wanted to make a few brief comments from the perspective of the profession's pensions board. Certainly, we don't want to take over anything that the regulators might want to do in this area. But we are conscious particularly of the need to make the whole subject of mortality and all the new research much more accessible to all pensions actuaries of firms of whatever size. There are various initiatives underway on that to provide more tools on projection methodologies. But what we haven't really talked about tonight as well is base mortality, which I think is something that, again, on the pensions side, we've in the past focused less on than we might. The SAPS investigation has already put out three working papers, and that is something that is obviously very new in the pensions arena, and as with everything to do with mortality, it will take time before we get any kind of trends out of that, but that is something else underway that I'm sure we'll come back to in more detail in the future.
Thank you very much, Gordon. Who's going to be next? No, are we all done? Last chance. Right, in that case, I would like to ask Richard Willetts to close the discussion.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mr. President. First of all, I'd like to thank Stephen for his excellent presentation this evening. Stephen has attempted to come up with, to use his own words, a simple and pragmatic solution to counter what seems to be one of the key flaws of the 92 series and interim cohort projections. And I think he's done this in a very clear, original and accessible manner, and I think he's to be congratulated for this. As someone who spends almost all of my working hours delving into the sort of minutiae of mortality statistics, I found Stephen's more sort of high-level approach really quite refreshing. Sometimes it makes sense to look at the bigger picture, and focusing on the life expectancy statistic actually helps to do this very well. I think Stephen's approach works well because it actually focuses on long-term trends rather than just the most recent changes in mortality. It's also provided us with a practical way of stripping out the impact of the cohort effects on the general pattern of mortality improvement. But most fundamentally, it sort of highlights and addresses one of the major faults of the 92 series projections, i.e. the very low rates of improvement projected into the future for certain ages and calendar years. Almost inevitably, given that the approach is deliberately simplistic, there are a number of features, which some people have mentioned already, of the methodology that I think are worth discussing some more. One point is that Stephen's calibration of the floor actually assumes that the absolute difference between population life expectancy at age 65 and the life expectancy of pensioners remains broadly constant. It's actually not particularly clear that this is a reasonable assumption, especially given that in practice this life expectancy gap has actually increased substantially in recent years. For example, in the early 1980s, the difference between England and Wales population and pensioner life expectancy, as given by the 80 series mortality tables, was only around 1.7 years, which is far less than the current differential. Secondly, as Stephen has already acknowledged, in order to strip out the impact of the cohort effect, what Stephen has actually done is ignored experience data from the last 10 years or so. And when you look closely at UK trend data from the most recent past, as a number of speakers have mentioned, such as Mr. Greenwood, what you see is that the pace of improvement has been accelerating steadily for people in all birth cohorts. So therefore, ignoring the most recent experience tends to understate the projected pace of improvement. A number of speakers have mentioned international trends, especially the situation in the US. the pace of improvement Stephen has used to project forward's life expectancy is 26 days per annum for females and 41 days per annum for males. Now, that actually equates to an increase in life expectancy at age 65 of 0.7 of a year per decade for females and 1.1 year per decade for males. And I think it's quite useful to compare those rates of change per decade with the pace of change seen in other developed countries similar to the UK who haven't experienced the same kind of cohort effects that we have in the UK. And what you see over the last 10 years in other developed countries is increases of, in Germany it's been 1.8 years, Italy 1.6 years, Japan 1.6, Canada 1.5, France 1.2, and even in the US it's been 1.2, so all higher than the 1.1 assumed in Stephen's projection. Again, I think this would tend to suggest the projected pace of improvement may be understated. Stephen acknowledges that his particular method doesn't specifically address the issue of allowance for the cohort effect and the pace to which that effect may sort of drop away over time. And Mr. Humble has mentioned the fact that there's a theory that part of the cohort effect is due to changes in smoking prevalence, and therefore, because smoking prevalence has stabilised, the cohort effect may begin to fade away, and therefore some of the cohort projections may be conservative. I think that the possible sort of problem with that is that smoking prevalence stabilised in the 1990s after very sharp falls in the 70s and 80s. But during the 1990s, and especially over the last 5 years or so, the cohort effect hasn't faded away at all. And in fact, the pace of improvement has actually been accelerating constantly. So even though it's an appealing idea in theory, it just doesn't seem to be happening in practice. And a problem with the medium cohort projection is that if you take males born in the mid-1930s, who are at sort of the epicenter of the cohort effect in terms of the general population, the suggested floor of 1.25% would actually begin to bite in just 6 years' time, in 2013, despite the fact that the current pace of improvement in the population of England and Wales for that birth cohort is actually about 4% per annum. So it's a very rapid tail-off assumed in the medium cohort basis. To me, it's clear that in most circumstances, as a couple of speakers have mentioned, that the medium cohort projection without any floor is no longer a suitable best estimate for pension scheme valuation. However, if I were to use the same kind of adjusted medium cohort currency as Stephen, I would place the floor somewhat higher, perhaps somewhere in the range 1.5 to 2% as a best estimate for males, and 1% to 1.5% as a best estimate for females. However, and I'd stress that those are best estimates rather than prudent numbers. And as several speakers, including Mr. Goford, has mentioned, life expectancy improvements may actually be far more dramatic than implied by these bases. In recent decades, we've seen the pace of mortality improvement accelerating steadily. And if the pace of improvement, pace of acceleration rather, were to continue into the future, perhaps fueled by increasingly rapid advances in medicine, then the life expectancy projections we've made to date would prove to be inadequate. And I'd estimate that a scenario of continued acceleration in the pace of improvement in line with the trend over the last couple of decades would actually add something in the region of $175 billion to pension scheme liabilities versus the bases that are currently being used for pension scheme valuation. A number of speakers have mentioned the need to understand the drivers of mortality improvements. And Mr. Ridsdale has mentioned a number of research projects that have started to look into these kind of factors. And I think this is something that the profession should very much support and encourage. And I think the views of the medical profession are ones that we should be increasingly factoring into our forecasts, which we acknowledge can never be precise, and we should always stress the uncertainty of forecasts. But I think bringing in the views of medical profession, demographers, epidemiologists and so on has got to be extremely beneficial for us. I agree with Mr. Liu about tools to visualise what improvements mean in terms of the future medical scenarios that would have to bring them about. And finally, Gordon Sharp mentioned making research more accessible to users. I think that's a particularly important point in relation to pension scheme valuations. I think it's very important for trustees to understand the kind of issues that we're dealing with in terms of mortality improvement. And I think this is one particular aspect that Stephen has done very well. I think his presentation was excellent and should be extremely accessible to a variety of different audiences. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. Stephen, is there anything you'd like to say in response to any of the comments?
Just a couple of remarks, if I may.
Firstly, I think I'd agree with almost all the comments that people have made, and thank you for those. I'd just like to pick up on a couple of particular things that were mentioned. The first was with regard to the danger of extrapolating trends, and I agree that this very simplistic extrapolation I've done is dangerous. But as Richard has said, it's also an easy way of communicating what we're doing with our clients. I acknowledge the danger of doing this, but I'd also perhaps like to look elsewhere in the world and see that actually, as Richard has pointed out, those extrapolations are well within the achievable limits of life expectancy we can see elsewhere in the globe. So there is a degree of sanity check on those extrapolations. And perhaps if I may make one final comment, I know that a number of speakers have referred to the uncertainty around mortality and the need to be aware of this and reserving potentially for it. And perhaps if I can give a brief viewpoint as from my personal experience, is that when discussing these kind of issues with clients, particularly sponsors of pension schemes, a number of them are now actually bearing this very much in their mind. And whilst they may be funding to a certain level, are holding back a degree of reserves in case mortality and longevity is better than already assumed. And I think that's showing that there is a first for this out in the marketplace. I think that's all I'd like to say. Thank you, President.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Stephen. Well, we've had a very interesting discussion this evening. I guess that this is an area to which the profession has been devoting an increasing amount of attention in recent years, but it's fairly clear that we've still got an awful lot to learn. There's been a large amount of capital made available to take on longevity risks by the new bulk annuity providers, and I guess it's reasonable to assume that they think they have a reasonable understanding of the risks involved in this area, and I'm sure there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes, as well as that's been made public. For the profession's part, Brian Ridsdale's referred to the various research projects, and Gordon Sharp alluded to the work of the Mortality Projections Task Force of the CMI, which will in due course be publishing a library of projections projection approaches, including Peace Blinds, Lee Carter cohorts and so on, with some notes on how to use them. And there are also plans to increase the amount of training and educational material and seminars available to help people to select the most appropriate projection methods for their particular situation. So we do recognise that this is a very important area for the profession, and are doing, I think, all we can to make sure that actuaries are up to speed and have the necessary tools to tackle it. So it just remains for me to express my own thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all those present, to Stephen in particular, and to Richard, and to all of those who've participated in this evening's discussion. And can we please show our appreciation in the usual way? I think one or two people had prepared notes. It will be very helpful for those who are preparing the transcript of the discussion for the BAJ if you could hand those to Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall as you leave the meeting. The next meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 o'clock on Monday, the 26th of March 2007, when a discussion on the Quiz 3 aspect of Solvency 2 will take place. So I expect another large audience for that. And finally, I'd like to invite you all to join me in continuing tonight's discussion over a glass of wine in the Council Chamber. And tonight's drinks are being sponsored by Hewitt. It's going to cost them quite a lot of money, judging by the number of people here. To help with the logistics, could those people who are seated in the council chamber please pick up their chairs and move them to the sides of the room to allow the drinks reception to take place? Thank you very much. I declare the meeting closed.